Hello, and welcome to the Strange Creator Podcast. I'm your host, M. Leonard.
It was not until his teenage years that Sandaljan began playing the violin, discovering what was to be a lifelong love of music. Despite his inauspiciously late start, Hagop set his sights on becoming a virtuoso and compensated for his lack of experience with endless hours of practice.
Let's start this episode by talking about Meghla Ponera Fotins, or most commonly known as the stink ant of the Cameroon of West Central Africa. This curious creature will scour the dense rainforest floor, looking for food within the fallen leaves and natural occurring growth that inhabit places like the Cameroon of West Central Africa. In doing so, the stink ant will unknowingly inhale a microscopic spore from a fungus called Tomentella, and like a horror movie, the spore will take over the ant's brain, causing it to act out in odd behaviors. The stink ant, after being driven to the edge with a brain-eating spore, will climb into the surrounding plants on a suicide mission, where it impales itself, thus being released from the clutches of an inescapable mind control. But the fun's not over yet. Over a few weeks' time, the fungus continues to grow until it becomes a spiked mushroom, thrusting out of this poor ant's head, only to rain down fresh spores onto the rainforest floor to infect its next stink ant victim. Now, this may sound like an odd history lesson from that very strange substitute teacher you had for a day back in the sixth grade. And it is, kind of. This is a strange bit of history taught by that strange substitute teacher that even though you only had them for a day, that particular history lesson was one you'll never forget. You might wonder, where did this person get their information? You may even wonder if this is even factual. Only these types of history lessons can be discovered at the Museum of Jurassic Technology, the curiously wonderful creation of filmmaker David Wilson.
The relationship of our museum to other museums we oftentimes see as a kind of metaphor of vision. If in the eye there's foveal vision, which is your precise, focused distance in the center, there is, on the other hand, an enormous amount of peripheral vision. Many museums focus on the foveal vision, a small body of material that is the center of the cultural vision. We think that's necessary and wonderful, but we've also discovered that so much of culture, so much of life, doesn't ever quite come into sharp cultural focus. And it turns out that this is a vast area. And that has been, to a great extent, the kind of matrix out of which our work at the museum has sprung.
During my wife's journey of becoming an archaeologist, part of her studies were to explore how artifacts from field discoveries were ultimately displayed in museums. I recall one spring afternoon, her coming home after a field trip of visiting museums in the Los Angeles area, completely floored about one of them. When I asked her what was so special about it, she was at a loss for words and that I needed to see it for myself. Not soon after, we were in the car headed to Culver City, a suburb of Los Angeles proper. I had been to this area dozens of times, having been born and raised in Los Angeles County, but never would have noticed the clever facade of the Museum of Jurassic Technology. Even when I was about to pass through its door, I thought to myself, what an odd place for a museum about dinosaurs. I was wrong on so many levels. For many of us, certainty in one's profession has the comforts of a warm security blanket. Knowing how much money will be coming in, having medical coverage, and maybe a savings tucked away somewhere are important to a good night's sleep and peace of mind. But for those chasing a passion, these luxuries happen on a case-by-case basis, like they did for David Wilson and his wife Diane. David Wilson, despite being a father, husband, and museum curator, is at his core a filmmaker. During a somewhat confusing and miserable 4 years at the Baptist-founded Kalamazoo College in Michigan, it was here that he would make his first film. The rest, as they say, is history. When I began my personal research for this episode, I was surprised to discover how David Wilson was so deeply rooted in filmmaking. However, many of the themes and topics covered in his museum demand a robust storytelling aspect. And simply visiting the museum feels like you're in an adventure movie, making that crucial discovery that turns the tide in the final act.
Only the last 15 years or so, it's been, the museum was in existence for, you know, a long time, at least 15 or so years before we started making films. But I personally came out of a filmmaking background, and through the early years of the museum, I got to, you know, yearning to make films again. So rather than, go off and make other films, I personally folded that into the museum like everything I do in life. And now with a group of people, we do about a film every 2 years or so. And it's been a great and wonderful expansion of our, you know, of our efforts. Exhibitions are enormously interesting and wonderful to produce, but it turns out that the amount of information that you can actually communicate in an exhibition is somewhat limited because, you know, it has to do with wall text, and people don't like to read enormous amounts of wall text. So the films have been a way for us to kind of expand on some of these areas of interest and communicate kind of deeper and with a different kind of, you know, set of parameters, some of this material that we like to put into the world.
Shortly after their marriage and moving to a remote part of rural Colorado, David and Diane Wilson sustained a simple life by creating commercials for the local merchants, and in doing so, developed their skills as creators. It was then the ambitious couple decided to head west after discovering the budding private arts institution CalArts in Santa Clarita, California. This trip was meant to be a short-lived adventure to further perfect their filmmaking skills. However, while away, everything they own was lost when their house in Colorado burned to the ground. For these two, there was no turning back. Having literally nothing to go back to demanded a deeper dive into their passions, leaving no opportunity unturned. This ultimately led to better gigs, important breakthroughs in their respective crafts, but most importantly, better creations, like the Museum of Jurassic Technology. For me, though, the most important takeaway from David Wilson and his wife Diane's journey is following a passion, no matter what the uncertainty that accompanies it. You never know where an uncompromising devotion to your craft could lead to.
I think, actually, we're much more interested in what your unmitigated, unmediated reaction to the film is than anything that may be informed by, you know, what we've talked about since. I think that, I think is true for most of, you know, the work we do at the museum. We try and not be didactic or instructive, and are more interested, I think, in presenting to people material that can conceivably be interpreted in multiple ways, not just a single way. And there is no right way to interpret it. But because we think that that way of presenting things is essentially more generous to the viewer, to the visitor, in that it allows that person to participate from a place in themselves that you're not able to participate from if, in fact, you're being told too much about what it is that you're seeing.
In 1872, a curious find was made in a remote part of the world. The dozo of the Tripuscum Plateau of the Circum-Caribbean region of northern South America, to be exact. The find was foundational information that led to the discovery of an advanced form of echolocation, which is a highly developed frequency-modulated radar found in most species of bats. Essentially, echolocation are high-pitched sonic beams that the bat uses to map out its surroundings. What was this find exactly? Quote, a small demon which the local savages believe able to penetrate solid objects, end quote. In other words, a bat that can penetrate objects such as walls, huts, and even a child's arm of all things. This bat, named the Deprong Mori, was something I'd never heard of, nor would I have ever heard of such a thing if it were not for the Museum of Jurassic Technology. Such an exhibit would require extensive data to determine whether or not something like this could exist. And there is a surprising amount of such data to back up this claim of an object-piercing white bat dubbed the Piercing Devil, one of which is an individual named Donald R. Griffith, whom in the 1950s took a team out into the field for extensive study on this object-piercing phenomenon. Griffith actually wrote a book on the echolocation subject, albeit his name was actually Griffin, not Griffith, according to a few Google searches. Was his name intentionally misspelled? And if so, why? Does the Deprong Mori actually exist? The museum exhibit makes it plausible, but in the little research I've done regarding the Piercing Devil, it's questionable. And that's the absolute beauty of David Wilson's museum, discovering something new about our precious existence in this strange world, then contemplating whether or not it's actually true. The Museum of Jurassic Technology is temporarily closed to the public due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Like the tens of thousands of business closures throughout the United States, the museum was not spared. Have we seen the last of this curious place? Judging from the previous track record of David and Diane Wilson, I sincerely doubt it. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Strange Creator. Tune in next week as we continue to explore the world's most amazingly strange attractions. Please feel free to contact us at thestrangecreatorpodcast@gmail.com.